Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 2, with author, rabbi, Israeli tour guide, and historian Ken Spiro, and myself, JFI director and educator Ellie Bass. This is a show where we look to the past in order to understand the present and plan for a better future. And this season, we're touring Israel and learning about each place and its part in our history and our lives as a Jewish people today. Okay, let's do this. All right. Welcome back, everyone, to Remember What's Next. Rabbi Ken Spiro, how are you?
I'm good. A little stressed. Making a wedding on Sunday night, marrying off my last kid on top of that.
Wow, mazel tov.
Going to the States 2 days later. I just came back from the States. But
bazinga time. It's a bazinga time.
Beautiful. It's
I get
huge.
To do the broom dance. Last kid.
Wow, beautiful. Amazing. Mazel tov, mazel tov. Are the digs open? Remember, you always used to give us a report on the archaeological
digs. Open, but I haven't been back in so long and I'm way too busy now. My life returns to normal after I get back. I'm gonna start going back, I hope.
Awesome. Okay.
Put my sister on. She was just there today. She'll be happy to tell you what she's digging up.
Okay. Yeah, that would be great. I would love it. All right. So let's dig into our topic for the week. It's kind of a two-parter, continuing from what we were speaking about last week. And this week we wanted to touch on the history of the oral law, how we relate to those laws today, how do we understand how much wiggle room is in the law, and is it different between written law and oral law? And when there is wiggle room, what are we doing when we're, you know, moving or changing how we practice the law, especially since we're in the Parsha this week about the Shemitah year, right. You know, or anything that has to do with debt forgiveness or the sort of Cheter Mechira or things like that. So how do we relate to that? So can we start with the history? Because as we're doing, remember what's next, sure. How do we look back in order to be able to understand where we're at now?
By the way, it's perfect timing. It just suddenly dawned on me. Wow, it's already dark here. It's Lag BaOmer here. Lag BaOmer is, you know, we're talking about, you're counting the Omer, the 33rd day of the Omer. Which is generally the period between Passover, leaving of Egypt. We start after the first night of Passover counting, and it's a very long cycle where we're preparing ourselves spiritually to accept the Torah, which is the holiday of Shavuot, on the 6th of Sivan. So there's no accidents. The timing is perfect. And it's also, you know, normally it's supposed to be thrown in there later in history as a period of mourning, which for many people ends now. Commemorating the death of the 12,000 pairs of students of Rabbi Akiva, who's like a super important person in the whole transmission process of the Torah. Also connected to the Yortzeit, the Azkara of the Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was a student of Rabbi Akiva's, who was also an incredibly important person in this whole transmission process. And of course, is a tremendous source of knowledge in terms of Jewish mysticism, being the author of the book called The Zohar, The Radiance. So it's like great convergence of everything. So there's no accidents.
100%. Plus, he had laser eyes, which is super cool, Rabbi Bar Yochai. So that'll be interesting to learn about a little bit more. I do want to mention, actually, before we go any further, that today's class is being sponsored in the merit of Refuah Shlema for Nacha Yafa Bas Rivka and for Yehudit Miriam Bas Malka Rachel. So may they have a complete and full Refuah Shlema and support and strength and all of those things. So,
Amen. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. You know, we talked about last week when we talked about the written law, this concept that, you know, there's many different uses of the word Torah, but to shrink it down to a little more than the five books and less than everything that every rabbi ever wrote. We talk about the most basic thing to understand, which people remarkably do not understand, is the oral law and the written law. Mm-hmm. Like, what are these things? And if it's oral, why is it written down today? When I did smicha myself, rabbinic ordination many, many years ago, the most interesting thing that I learned, besides all the technical stuff about being a rabbi, was klalei hora'ah. Like, how does one reach an opinion in halacha? No one ever actually explained that to me. And I'm actually kind of shocked at how many guys who even spend years in yeshiva are lacking in some very basic knowledge, not about how to observe Shabbat and things like that, but in terms of the whole history and the transmission process and who is what and where they fit in and why things are written down. So we understand that, as I mentioned, a quick review, that the five books of Moses, anything in the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible, was basically, according to Jewish tradition, that book was closed at the time of the Babylonian exile by the men of the Great Assembly, who were the emergency expanded Jewish Supreme Court Sanhedrin of 120 rabbis in a 100-year period between basically 410 and 310 BCE. They closed that book, and anything in that book has to be authored by a prophet and has to contain a message that is relevant to us. The five books of Moses, which have a unique status, because Moses is considered to be the greatest prophet, and his level of prophecy has a unique status in that God speaks to him, as God himself says in the Bible, I speak to him directly. He hears my words. He doesn't have visions. He doesn't go into a trance. So the actual words, written Torah, of the, you know, the Chumash, the five books, are the first four books are God dictating to Moses, and the fifth book, Deuteronomy, Devarim, is Moses' closing speech, which is in his words, which God allows him to include in with the other four books. But what's really important, and even more important in many ways than those five books, is that oral law. And as I mentioned last week, well, whereas Moses wrote during the 40 years in the desert different parts of the five books of Moses, anything that happened previously, he could write up until that point. He obviously is not writing prophetically about the big mistakes we'll make in the future, like the story of the spies. Before he dies, he completes the writing of the five books. And the four books includes his fifth book, his closing speech, and makes 13 copies, as we mentioned, one for each tribe and one that sits in the Holy of Holies. But as I also mentioned last week, we're counting up towards Shavuot now. At Shavuot, at the holiday, 6th of Sivan, the Jewish people basically accept the concept of Torah in theory. That's the national revelation, a unique historical experience where everyone, the entire nation, hear God speak. The purpose of that is obviously, since all the Torah we keep today is based on Moses coming down the mountain saying, here's what I learned from God and here's what you got to do. You know, how do we know, God forbid, that Moses didn't make it up? And he went up there and just sat there for 40 days, brought up like a lot of freeze-dried food and sat up there like thinking things up. So right, God says to Moses, you stand aside at Shavuot. You stand aside. I'm going to speak to the Jewish people directly, all of them, in a unique historical experience, which will never be duplicated again, God himself says, and has never happened in human history because God is God and he knows he's not going to do it to anyone else. We all get to hear him directly so that we know that whatever Moses tells us from now on is, in fact, the word of God. So we get a glimpse of that.
And I think if I understand correctly, it's the only national claim of national revelation. I don't think there's any other ancient peoples that say everybody heard this God speak to them.
Right. Yehuda Halevi, the great medieval Jewish scholar, brings this down in his book, The Kuzari, and the uniqueness of Torah and its claim, as opposed to, let's say, Muhammad going into a cave and claiming the angel Gabriel appears to him and tells him to start reciting. You can't prove or disprove that, but only he experienced that. But when Moses then goes after the national revelation, which happens when Moses is at the bottom of the mountain, he goes back up the mountain and he spends 40 days learning the oral law. Now this, we have to understand that, as I mentioned last week, the written law is not what we learn Jewish law from. We call it the written law, the Torah, the instructions, shebichtav, that are written. As I said last week, it's really a book of hashkafah. It's your Jewish worldview. It's your basic software operating platform. We don't learn Jewish law ever from statements made within the written law. Only like fundamentalist Christians, like I said, you know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You poked out mine, I'm poking out yours. That's not how we do it. So that's a hashkafah. But to live as a Jew is the oral law, which Moses, not to go through the whole chronology again, we did that last class, but twice he has to do this because of the golden calf in the middle. God hits the hard delete on his brain and he has to go back up and do it again. But what he's learning at Mount Sinai is the Torah Shebal Peh, you know, from his mouth, the oral law. Oral law meaning, this is the simple definition I mentioned before and I have to mention again, I make all my students memorize this, is the oral law is the 613 commandments not just the 10 that he brings down on the tablets. Those 10 encapsulate everything else, as many books and things written about that. Again, not our topic, but it's the 613 commandments and the principles of how to apply them. In its purest, most undiluted definition, that is really important to remember. So the five books of Moses, that is Jewish worldview or hashkafah. The oral law is what Moses spends all that time learning and then teaching to the Jewish people after, is the 613 commandments and the principles of how to apply them. So that is how we live as a Jew. And those commandments we know are divided up into chukim and mishpatim, laws that relate to our relationship with God, kashrut, Shabbat, spiritual laws, and then mishpatim, which are societal laws, property ownership, marriage, divorce, and, you know, civil law, all that other stuff, damages. And it's a corpus. You have to also appreciate that Judaism is a holistic worldview. It's not a religion in the sense that it just deals with spirituality. There's nothing that can happen in our lives that is outside of the purview of what we call halakha. And halakha is the byproduct, the way, what it really means, is the byproduct of our understanding, transmission, adaptation of these 613 commandments, the principles, how to apply them, which, and this is where it gets really interesting, have gone through much evolution in history. And that's where it gets really complicated.
Right. So for me, one of the questions that I have is there anything in the oral law that is utterly unique or not mentioned at all in the written law?
Details, absolutely, but the principles, no. Every commandment, every mitzvah is mentioned.
Right. It all speaks to each other somehow. So the oral law and the written law literally go together as a package deal. There's no laws that are in the oral law that you can't source in the written law. Is that, am I understanding
that correctly?
Basically,
they're there. But without any details, like I said, that's one of the great proofs that there has to be an oral law, because the Torah makes some very brief statements, you know, lo tasu b'malacha, don't do work on Shabbat, but it doesn't explain what it is. Like I said, you know, it says put a mezuzah on the doorpost of your house, but in Hebrew, the doorpost is the mezuzah.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. How do we know the parchment, how you put it? And there's different opinions about that, but it all falls in within the mitzvah of mezuzah, you know, to fill in. It doesn't, nowhere does it say, it says, l'totafot ben inecha, there'll be like a, what is a totafot, like? Or frontlet, is that they translate in English. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? How do you know how it looks like, color, what's inside it, the parchment? So it's clear, anyone looking at it objectively would say, whoever the author is of those five books clearly understood that you heard other things besides what he's just writing down in the book, because it's just missing all the practical details of how to.
And that's where one of the questions that came up in one of our other classes, which is, why wasn't it just simply written then in a way that we could understand it? Like, why not make the written law clearer?
Okay. So the written law, first of all, is very clear. It's gotten less clear as we go on. That's due to any number of historical circumstances.
Right. We don't have historical context for some things. We don't even know what some of the words are anymore.
But also the weakening of the train and transmission, the scattering of Jewish communities. We have to remember that the ideal situation we're supposed to be in after we got that Torah was to enter the land of Israel. No Jews living on Bathurst and something and Long Island. And all Jews living in the land of Israel with a unique religious governmental structure, which was designed to then, you know, like any government's job is to basically, you know, legislate and adjudicate. That's the system, primarily done by one of the three branches of Jewish structure, which is kingship, which is chief political leader, priesthood, and the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court of 70, 71 judges. Their job is to adjudicate and legislate. But ideally, the Jews would have had that body in perpetually throughout history, being the sole legal authority, like the Supreme Court is the ultimate legal authority in the United States to decide on, you know, interpretation, application of law. But because we lost that, we were scattered around the world, we lost a centralized institution to make decisions that would be relevant to the entire Jewish people. Things got much more cloudy and iffy. But initially, if you follow, you know, I mentioned this in the last class too, if you read in the beginning of the Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, which is in the Mishnah, it starts out with a statement explaining the transmission of this oral law, which is the fundamental part of being a Jew. That's, by the way, oral law only we have. We don't teach the oral law to non-Jews. The rest of the world has gotten a hold of our Bible, especially Christianity, and is grossly misinterpreted, you know, mistranslated often, used it against us, and don't pay us any royalties for it. But the oral law is something specific to us. You know, that and if you read in the Ethics of the Fathers, it says Moses got the Torah from Sinai, which means the oral law. And the reason why, Ellie, we call it oral, is once you write something down, it ossifies. Once it's in writing in print, it becomes much less flexible. So there was actually a prohibition against writing the oral law down. Not that you couldn't take your own notes. Like, let's say you and I are sitting in a class and the teacher's speaking. We can take all the notes we like on what the teacher's saying for our own personal use and to use it to transmit to others. What we can't do is go print it. Here's the teacher's notes. I'm going to make money off it, that kind of thing. Because the idea was, and this is a fundamental difference between Jewish law and everyone else's, is it's based on principle and not precedent. There was an interesting story I heard years ago. I don't know the details of it, but a couple, German, man, woman, husband, wife, were both lawyers who converted to Judaism because someone showed them that all the laws of torts can be learned out of one volume of the Rambam. You go to a law library and it's shelves and shelves of millions of pages of legal precedents, which are always changing. And so first of all, it's God. He gives you the principles of an absolute, but the fact that it's based on principles that never change, yet the application of the principles can definitely change. For instance, damages, you know, there's always been a hole in the ground that people can fall into, but there is today, you can be electrocuted and be hit by a car. Those were not things that happened thousands of years ago. Then you could be gored by an ox or, you know, burned by a fire. Now the principles behind the damages are the same, which is why anyone who learns Nazikin knows that you learn all the principles of damages, even today, could be learned from a goring ox, a biting ox, a fire in a pit.
Right.
But it's a lot harder to extrapolate those principles out. It's much less clear. Had the Sanhedrin, and we stayed in the land of Israel for thousands of years, and the Sanhedrin been functioning the whole time, today the oral law we'd be learning would be using current technological examples, because those would have been adapted to fit the principles which never change.
Right. So the goring ox, the falling into a pit, the burned by a fire, contains all of the DNA that then gets expressed into all of these different practical applications, no matter where you are in time or space.
Right, exactly. Okay. So that's a very unique system. So when we say oral law, it's not that you can't write it down, but it just shouldn't be written down as a definitive final version, which it was, by the way, and I want to get to that because that's super important to understand. But now we understand that we Jews there's principles that we base our laws on, and there are also principles, there's these 13 principles of how you extrapolate. And it's way too complicated to get in this class, but you have to have a certain high level of knowledge. Just as a Supreme Court justice, you ever heard lawyers speak legalese? They throw out concepts in law which are used to define and focus a law and adapt a law, change a law based on this and that. So Judaism also has very specific principles of how you can, change is not the right word to use, but how you can extrapolate, pull out new principles, how you can apply them within certain guidelines. But it's also super fundamental to understand that as someone who considers himself to be believing Jew Orthodox, the belief in God as the source of the law, Moses' prophecy being unique and having unique status, both in the written law and the oral law, and the immutability of the Torah, meaning it can be adapted, but it does not change. We don't drop things. Rabbis are given permission to adapt, you know, add fences, suspend certain regulations because they're not relevant today, but it's immutable, it's eternal, and it's from God. So that's why Jews are so obsessed with it. This is the word of God. This is how we individually and collectively live, and this is how we connect to the creative universe. He gave us a system, and he gave us leadership, whose job it was too. And this is the job of rabbis throughout history, which is, of course, that is also morphed as their role has changed with the loss of other organs of Jewish governance and central authority, But the fundamental job of the rabbis, as is brought down in the Ethics of the Fathers, beginning with Moses, who's the rabbi of all rabbis, is to first of all, the chain of transmission, passing on the chain of, and the adaptation and application are the next functions of their jobs.
Okay, so I'm so glad we're going there, because that's the, I think, where we don't have a picture of our, in our minds of how does the oral law get transmitted faithfully, and why do we trust what people are saying to be accurate, especially since we've all played the broken telephone game. And so what are we, how, like, and especially because it's not written down. So we can't, like you said, turn to a Dead Sea Scroll and see what's written there and say, of course, what we're saying now is what we said then. And, exactly. And on one hand, why create a system like that that's so loose in a certain way, but how do we trust the system? How do we understand? And what did that look like? Can you give us a picture of how this was transmitted person to person?
Yeah. So first of all, we have this concept we call rabbinic ordination, which is smicha, which means you place your hands. Today, I got smicha. A lot of people have smichas. A lot of rabbis running around, but that's basically a degree. You finish a certain body of study, you take your tests, written and oral, depending on how you do it, and you get rabbinic ordination from different rabbis. There's no universal standard of that either, by the way. But smicha used to be, it was a direct transmission, meaning up to a certain point in history, going back like 600 years ago, any rabbi could tell you who he learned his Torah from. He learned whose rabbi's rabbi was back to Moses. Which means you had a chain, shalshalat ha-kabbalah, a chain of transmission. You actually had a formal process. Rabbinic ordination today is not what it used to be back thousands of years ago, when it was literally this direct transmission. Today, I can't tell you who I just study the books. I know people who do it online, virtual smicha, you know. Used to be, you sat, Moses, when he learns the Torah, he spends a year in the desert teaching it to the Jewish people. But in the Ethics of the Fathers, it says Moshe got the Torah from Sinai. He gets it from God. He gives it to Joshua. Joshua then becomes the next person in that chain of transmission, whose job is to transmit the 613 commandments and the principles of how to apply them to the prophets, right. The Zakenim, excuse me,
right.
The elders. Joshua, the elders give it to the prophets. The prophets give it to the men of the great assembly. And then then Perkei Avot stops with the chain of transmission. But what it's giving us there is it's telling us from teacher to student who received these principles and who they passed it on to and what generations it went through, which body of people had the responsibility of then interpreting and applying it. But the chain of transmission doesn't stop with the men of the great assembly. It's just where Perkei Avot stops talking about it, because then we enter the Second Temple period, and that's a totally different reality. And so much of what you're asking has to do with the changing historical realities of what happens in the Second Temple period,
right.
When A, there's no kingship. There's a couple of kings, but none of them are legitimate descendants of King David. The priesthood becomes corrupted very, very rapidly, especially under the influence of Greeks, where the office is going to be bought and sold. Prophecy has ceased, which is really important because there's no one who has a direct connection with God.
Right.
What sort of a Jewish version of broken telephone starts to work out here, where people start to hear slightly divergent things. Now, but what does exist, however, is the Sanhedrin. There is a central body of the 71 rabbis, who, when a number of different rabbis would bring them the opinions, here's what I heard from my rabbi, here's what I heard from my rabbi, here's what I heard from my rabbi about the exact same issue, they could adjudicate and decide. And the basic principle is, once God gives the Torah to Moses, lo bashamayim, he doesn't decide. There's a famous story in the Talmud of one rabbi versus the entire rest of the Sanhedrin. He is positive he is right. He says, if I am right, the walls of the Beit Midrash should move and miracles, and all these things happen. And the head of the Sanhedrin says, no, we don't. We go acharam. We go according, lo bashamayim. It's not in heaven. God gave it to us. We, as the rabbis, have the authority to go after the majority opinion and decide how we're going to apply that law. And that was what was done by the Sanhedrin to reach a unified consensus. Like in the Supreme Court in America, you have a dissenting opinion, but you right. go according to the majority.
Right.
So that's like a huge thing to understand in terms of the principle. But the further we go away the more fuzzy things get around the edges. Mm. And you see, so, and if we could, and there's so much to talk about here, because we go from the period of Greek occupation, land of Israel, with this open persecution of Jewish observance and the teaching of the Torah. We managed to survive that with the Maccabees. But again, the precarious situation the rabbis find themselves in makes it harder to meet, harder to teach, harder to pass on. Not only that, and this, by the time you get to the Second Temple period, not all the Jews come back to the land of Israel. You now have a diaspora community, which is relying on Jerusalem, because as long as the Sanhedrin existed, which is going to be, by the way, until the mid-4th century of the Common Era, they had the authority to decide for the entire Jewish world. You had rabbis in Babylon who were working, but ultimate authority went to the Sanhedrin. The problem is, Ellie, once we go from the Greeks, we enter the period of Roman occupation of the land of Israel, beginning in the year 63 BCE with Pompey Magnus arriving. And that's a very difficult relationship that lasts for several centuries. We have three major revolts, two in Israel and one in diaspora. The most destructive, of course, is the one is the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70. But in terms of real destruction, probably Bar Kokhba is worse, from 132 to 135. And and this is taking place.
Is Bar Kokhba the last one? That's the last of the revolts?
The last one. And that is triggered by the Roman Emperor Hadrian basically trying to, you know, redux on what the Greeks did in Hanukkah, where Hanukkah was a paganism's war, not against Jews, but against Judaism, the world's only monotheistic faith. And they attacked the central tenets of Judaism, knowing that if we undermine the ability to teach Torah, the ability to calculate our calendar, to sanctify the new month, things like that, we will destroy the Jewish people, because what keeps us Jewish is keeping the oral law, not having a Bible in our bookshelf. The Roman Emperor Hadrian also does the same thing, and in many ways much harsher. And the situation in the Jewish world is much weaker. We've gone through a lot of devastation. A lot of Jews, many more Jews have left the land of Israel, like what you have in Ukraine. There's a war going on, there's constant revolt. It's a tense place to live in Israel during this time. So Jews go to greener pastures to get away from the front line sometimes. So it's during this period of time, and the rabbis at this period of time, post facto historians, we've sort of labeled different periods of time, giving rabbis, like you have Generation X, Gen Z. Mm-hmm. We go from a period of time of right before the turn of the Common Era, the Zugot, where there's two pairs of rabbis who are running the Sanhedrin. And then we go to a period of time from about the year one, more or less, to the year 200, that we call a period of the Tanoim. Tana is one who teaches. And they all have the title Rebbe. So any rabbi you hear with the name Rebbe going back then, we're talking about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But,
right. But you mean in the Talmud when we hear Rebbe.
Rebbe. He's right. He's a Tana. And the Tanaim are the people who are responsible for what we're going to call the Mishnah, the writing of the Mishnah. Now, it's also super important to understand, I've hit the pause button there. This is such an important idea for anyone listening to understand, is unlike today, we think that anyone as old is in the way. There used to be a rock group called Old and in the Way. And obviously, because you don't know how to use your technology, you can't text on your phone without looking at it. Judaism has the exact opposite understanding. Nothing to do with specifically with age. You know, past a certain age, you know, I'm forgetting where my car keys are. That's not the issue. But the notion that everything newer is better is a total antithesis to what Judaism says. The reality is the closer you are to Mount Sinai, the clearer the transmission of Torah, and therefore the higher level your authority is, which means that just like in an army, the sergeant has more authority over the corporal and the general has more authority over the major, so too Moses has Moses's Torah, and his authority is greater than Joshua's, and Joshua's is greater. And it's called Yiridot HaDorot, the decline of the generations. This is so super important, because the foundation of the transmission process of Torah is the notion that even when you want to adapt or innovate the halacha, it has to be based on something earlier. Must be. Any Tana learned his Torah from someone who came before him, and he could clearly tell you who he got it back to, going back all the way to Moses at Mount Sinai. And it's also if you look at it sort of like as an image, you know, Moses at the bottom, and the more we spread out, the more Jews exist in the world, the more people learning Torah and teaching it, you're going to get a wider divergence of opinions on any number of issues. But as you take them back, you narrow it down to eventually you're going to have one opinion. And when and even if there's a divergence of opinion, as long as the Sanhedrin was around and it exists during that period of time of the Tanaim until around the year 200, even if there is fuzziness around the edges, the Sanhedrin is still in a position to say, okay, yeah, this opinion, that opinion, but here's the halacha. And to add another hugely important comment into that, you know, people say, what do you mean rabbis don't agree? They never agree on anything. The whole Talmud is everyone arguing. There's a tremendous amount of disagreement, but it's always within red lines. That is just so important to understand. You know, like for instance, in the laws of a man marrying a woman, he has to give her an article of value to show his seriousness of intent. That's the ring ceremony we do. And then, and you see all the rabbis will agree on that. What they fight over is how much it has to be worth.
Right.
$15, $20, $50, 15 cents, whatever. But within red lines, no one's saying eat pork, don't eat pork.
Now, there are right, and no one's saying you don't need to do that at all. It's actually, you know, they just have to say certain things.
So they, you know, they say, you know, there's an expression, the devil's in the detail. It's actually the divinity's in the detail. But the arguing is, and the discussions, which by the way, so hones the Jewish mind. I mean, it's innate in Jewish personality from Abraham, not to accept things, to think outside the box, but it's the desire to get to the, even if the actual differences are not necessarily related to the practical application, it's to get to the kernel of truth that is within there and the principle that allows us to understand and apply. So that is so important to appreciate, because that's the difference between what we call Orthodox Judaism and everyone else. The notion that we are in a chain of transmission, that we can rewind back to the beginning, and we're not saying anything now that isn't based on something that was said before. And I, as a rabbi today, cannot just throw things out that I think this is how I interpret the text. No, it's not how it works. Then you have a complete disintegration of a system. That's what happens in history. That's what happened to the Jewish people who left that behind. That's what happened. A fantastic example of that is the conservative movement today, by the way, that unlike other versions of Judaism, like Reform, followed a supposedly halachic process, but because they broke with basic principles, it completely disintegrated and is now a non-halachic movement today. It's a whole separate topic for discussion. We'll have it at a later date, maybe. But if we could go back to, and I know I'm throwing out a lot of information, I hope it's clear, and please, Ellie, stop me if you want to throw in a question here. If we follow what happens with the next generation of rabbis, which is taking place precisely at this very difficult period of time, which is the second century of the Common Era, which the Bar Kokhba revolt ends in 135, with the massive destruction of the land of Israel, the slaughter of a huge percentage of the rabbinic leadership. There's, you know, Rebbe Akiva's 24,000 students died, they said, of the plague. That's what we're mourning. And this is what the period of mourning is ending now, Lag BaOmer. That I'm, as a historian rabbi, I think that's completely not, that's the Talmud is very often polemical and speaks encoded. No question in my mind that the 12,000 pairs of students that died, that were Rebbe Akiva, who was the central authority in the transmission process, this, the narrow pipe that the whole Torah is going through, is him and his students. He backed Bar Kokhba in the revolt. The revolt failed. Bar Kokhba was killed. Rebbe Akiva was skinned alive by the Romans for publicly teaching Torah. And I'm pretty sure that all of his students died because they were fighting with Bar Kokhba against the Romans.
Right.
The Romans killed hundreds of thousands of people. So the chain of transmission, which until then had been a rope, now, I mean, you've ever seen it like a rope that frays and there's just like one narrow string left? It got down to the part where Rebbe Akiva, there's like two great stories. One is Yehuda ben Baba. He's hiding. The Romans are hunting down the rabbis to snuff out the chain of transmission, knowing if we end this, we end the Jewish people. Hmm. And there's a famous story in Tainit. I'm not 100% sure. I think it's in Tainit, the Tractate Tainit, where Yehuda ben Bava he sneaks in between two cities, between Usha and Shfaram, where the Sanhedrin sat in both places, so the Romans couldn't take collective punishment on one of the cities for violating Roman law. And in hiding in a forest, he ordains five people as rabbis, including Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Meir, who's a very important. And it's such an amazing story. And he he actually says, you are the last five people in the chain of transmission that learn the Torah going back to Moses, and they hear the Romans coming. And Yehuda ben Bava says, flee. And his students say, his five students say, and these are the same five students Rabbi Akiva also takes them and teaches them, the two are connected. It's the same five students, if I'm not mistaken, that are the last little thread in the chain of transmission. They say to Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, like, you come with us. And he goes, I'm too old. I'm not going to move. I'm staying here. And they run away and they survive. And it says the Romans didn't leave Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava till they had pierced him with so many spears, he leaked like a sieve. But at that moment in Jewish history, the Jewish people were on the brink of spiritual and therefore physical extermination. So those five students that Rabbi Akiva, were the same five guys who end up continuing the chain of transmission after, are able to then teach other students, and the rope gets re-threaded, so to speak.
So I think there's two pieces that are interesting to me about what you're saying. So first of all, that story is just, of course, hair-raising. And but it's interesting because I can sometimes forget that we say oral law as if it's just a bunch of people talking. But if we think about it, what he did with those five rabbis technically was, if he had it as scrolls, right, he would have just handed it to them and said, take these with you, go hide them, go make sure that they're disseminated outside. But but they're not scrolls, they're virtual scrolls, so to speak. Like, here's the transmission of all of this information. You're carrying it within you, which speaks so deeply to what we say. For instance, when we say that you stand for somebody when they come into the shul who knows a lot of Torah, because they carry the Torah within them, which I'm assuming is a type of oral law. And in fact, we even stand for somebody who, say, has completely lost their memory, but used to be a Torah scholar, because we say that all of that Torah is still within them, even if they can't recall it intellectually. And so in a way, the oral transmission is really taking the words and putting them into that person. So then they take those words and put them into the next person, and so on and so on and so on. So it's a really interesting way of thinking about it, that's different from just thinking about it as, you're just telling me something and then I tell somebody else.
Right, exactly. And that story is important to understand. It's not like, just like even when I got smicha, there was nothing to compare. I had done all the study. That was just the ceremony. You know, Yehuda ben Bava ordaining them, so to speak, you know, he's saying, you guys, here, you got the mission. I pass on the baton to you. But they had already learned. They had been learning, you know, Rabbi Akiva. They had reached an incredible, unlike today where we don't know anything. Our phones know everything. No one remembers anything anymore. These people absorbed a tremendous amount. And of course, they could have taken all the notes they like. Now, what happens is then, from then on, for the next, until the year 200, thereabouts, give or take, which is the end of the period of the Tanayim, you have a rabbi named Yehuda Hanasi, Rebbe. He's also known as Rebbe, and he's one of the last Rebbe people. He is so significant, we just call him Rebbe. He is at a period of time where there's a couple of Roman emperors, Caracalla, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. We're not sure who, but there's a couple of interesting stories in the Talmud of Rebbe and Antoninus, that he had a relationship with one of the Roman Caesars who came later, who, unlike people like Trajan and Hadrian, became huge anti-Semites and persecutors of the Jews, these guys were like Marcus. If it is Marcus Aurelius, he was one of the great Stoic philosophers. Mm-hmm. And in the Talmud, it has Rebbe and Antoninus. The problem is Antoninus is a family name, so we're not sure which. But they interacted. But bottom line, what we take from that is the Romans chill out with the Jews for a while. There's been a lot of persecution. Rabbinic authority is weakened. You know, Jews are scattered everywhere. The Sanhedrin is moving from place to place. It already left Jerusalem with the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. And it moved from Yavna to Husha to Shfaram to Beit Sharim to Tzipori, where Rebbe's living at the time of the story I'm telling you. Okay, so it's moving around, sometimes in hiding, trying to reconstitute itself in a very precarious situation, like the underground. But he sees, we have a window of opportunity where we have Roman emperors who are not persecuting us so much, but the situation is precarious and it could very likely get worse. So what he does is he gathers together, basically, all the different oral traditions he can get from as many different Tanayim as he can, which is a massive amount of information, and he condenses it down into what we know as the Mishnah. And this is the first attempt to basically write down the oral law. Why? And again, just as I said, the simplest definition of the oral law is the 613 commandments and the principles of how to apply them. The way I define the Mishnah, this is, again, super important to remember, and I tell all my students to memorize this before you start learning Mishnah. You got to know what it is. It's a cryptic codification of the oral law designed as a memory device to keep it from being forgotten.
Got it. So if we were to just sit down and read the Mishnah and mistake it for how the oral law was transmitted from person to person, we're not really, that's not what it is. This is like, it's like looking at anagrams and thinking those are the words.
Right. Well, first of all, it's not the original. Moses heard God say things in a certain way. Like, just as like I said, Moses heard, you know, like if the Sanhedrin was still alive today, Moses heard cow, we hear car. So the principles are always in there. The actual words are largely gone by this point. But he has to decide. He says, first of all, we got too much stuff. We got so many different details, so many different versions, you know, like how many different opinions versus how valuable the ring has to be. We can't do every opinion there. It has to be memorizable. And so he condenses it down into there's 63 chapters of the Mishnah divided into six basic sidra, the six volumes, so to speak, of the Mishnah. And those six volumes cover all aspects of Jewish law. The first one I always say is Zrayim, it's seeds. I create a little sentence to memorize this. You can plant seeds in the holidays for women, but it damages the holiness and the purity. And it doesn't make sense. That's how I learned it when I was learning
it. That's like your code.
That's my code. But right. Zrayim is it's got Mishnah, it's got chapters in Mishnahs, and that deals with all the agricultural laws. Then you have Moed, which means time, which is all the Jewish holiday cycle, the holidays and Shabbat. And then you have Nashim, which is women, which is all the laws dealing with marital relationships, marriage, divorce, and everything else in there. Then you have Nezikim, which is the laws of damages. And then you have Kodshim, which is the laws of sacrifice. And this is stuff that's they're very difficult to learn precisely because it's very technical, A, and B, and not relevant, B, because we don't have the temple. Mm-hmm. And also Tahara, which is the laws of purity. Another thing which we really don't keep today because we don't have the sacrificial laws,
right?
Which also is going to be important when we talk about the creation of the Talmud. So there's 63 chapters altogether in the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, the six volumes of the Mishnah divided into 63 chapters as a cryptic codification, and it's an emergency measure. It should, in an ideal situation, it would never have been written down because once you write it down, it ossifies.
It becomes suddenly static and harder to have flexibility.
Exactly.
In order to apply it to particular circumstances. And the desire was, as long as it remains oral, it remains flexible and able to be applied to multiple different types of situations.
Right.
And that's what we see partly is once it becomes, say, the Shulchan Aruch, right, where it's like written down, now suddenly we're relating to it as black and white rather than something that's supposed to
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's why we, till today, we learn the damages, laws of damages from the goring ox and the biting ox. And if it had stayed in oral tradition, we would literally be using the same principles behind the goring and the biting ox, but we would be talking using modern technology. Now it would be considered our Mishnah today, as opposed to our modern application of halacha principles that are stated in the Mishnah. Now, that's the year 200. But unfortunately, by the situation does not, I mean, that Yehuda HaNasi, it's called Eis Lasos Hashem. He did something, he violated the prohibition against writing down the oral law to save the oral law. You know, it's like for the greater good. You're allowed to do that in Jewish law, violate certain principles for the bigger picture. Like you can violate the Shabbat to save a Jew's life, you know, because you're saving a life and he'll keep all his other Shabbats that he's now alive to keep, kind of thing. So you have these ideas that you have to know when to apply them. But after Rebbe dies, we enter a period of time called the Amora. A Tana is one who teaches from the year like 1 to 200 thereabouts. An Amora is one who says, and that more or less goes from after the year 200 till late in the 5th century, the Common Era, around 473 or so. And these are the guys who are in the chain of transmission, they're passing the Mishnah on, but as central authority gets weaker and weaker, by the mid-fourth century, by the way, the Sanhedrin, which has now moved to Tiberias, the Sanhedrin was supposed to always sit in Jerusalem, but it's moving around. Roman persecution gets so bad that that period of time, the Sanhedrin ceases to exist in the middle of the fourth century. So you have no longer one central body that can adjudicate everything. That's already a huge change. But now you have the rabbis, the chain of transmission, because central authority is weakened, persecution increases, Jews are more scattered. We need a further deeper understanding. Just as the Mishnah, by the way, is something that only makes sense. I'll give you a great example. If you go to class and you take notes on what your teacher says, and you look at them the next day or 3 weeks later for the final, they'll make sense to you. If you don't look at those notes for 10 years, I did this, my parents told me, made Aliyah, they're cleaning out their house. They said, could you come down to the basement and throw out all your notebooks from college? You know, it's like years later. And I look at these notebooks, I'm going through them, you know, and one of them says trigonometry. And I see it's my handwriting. It's Vassar College, you know, notebooks in the bookstore. I looked at it, could have been Swahili. I had absolutely no idea what it was about, because the Mishnah is not that it's a memory device. Right. It's assuming you know a certain amount of information. But as that gets weaker and the chain of transmission is weakened because of the external circumstances, then what's going to be created, and this is another, is the Talmud. And the Talmud is basically a further elucidation of the Mishnah.
So meaning of the things that we are still carrying that are still flexible, so that we can still argue it, because you already have a lot of the background that you've been taught and so on and so forth. Now we're taking even those extra pieces of oral law and writing those things down.
Because it's become less clear. We just need more of a discussion to try to figure out what's going on in the Mishnah and how do we actually, but the rabbis in the Talmud, the Amora, as they're called, who have the title Rav, anything they want to say to explain, interpret, apply has to be based on something that a Tana said from the Mishnah. So they can't just, I don't like any of what those guys said in the Mishnah. I'm making up my own thing.
Right.
So we're creating
a hierarchy of arguments. The further back you can go, the more legitimacy your argument has. But it always has to go back, not forward.
And you have different Amorayim quoting different Tanayim to say their case. Now, the question is, that's the whole language of the Gemara. Anyone who's learned Gemara knows. And eventually the Gemara will present all different cases so you understand the principles and you want to get to the truth. But eventually you'll say, but this is how we, practically speaking, this is how we paskin. But by this point, you're now going to get a situation in the world where different Jews around the world will go according to different opinions in the Gemara. Not everyone holds in the same way. But again, it's all within the red line. So no one is going to be wildly out there in left field saying something in the...
Right, like no one's saying Shabbat's now on Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever. So you have to appreciate this is where people lose it, because, you know, this rabbi... No, they're all following these certain rules, this chain of transmission. And the Talmud, by the way, because the Talmud is dealing at a time when the temple's destroyed, whereas the Mishnah deals with laws of animal sacrifice and purity and things related to the temple, the Talmud doesn't deal with that. So the Talmud, there's two Talmuds, by the way. There's scholars in Babylon, which is today Iraq, also compiling their version of it. It's called the Bavli. And there's also the Yerushalmi. It was actually composed in Tiberias, but out of respect for Jerusalem, which was then a city where Jews were even banned from living in, they called the Jerusalem Talmud. It happens to be that the Jerusalem Talmud was, because of the pressure in Israel and the persecution, was nowhere near as well edited. It didn't have anywhere near as much time to be worked on. So it's much harder to learn. It's much smaller and it's much more difficult to learn. The Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, and these scholars interact. It's not like we have two different Talmuds in different places, and they're interacting with each other. This is BC before cell phones, so they can't be sending in text messages about what they're learning and asking for an immediate response. But they're all, both Talmuds are based on the Mishnah going back, so neither of them is outside those red lines. They're all operating within the same principles. But today, when people learn halacha, when we learn Talmud, almost everyone's learning the Bavli. The Daf Yomi cycle is based on the Babylonian Talmud. But what the Talmud is a further discussion of the Mishnah to try and understand the principles in it to come out with some practical application, which is why the Talmud is so important. And by the way, neither Talmud covers all 63 chapters of the Mishnah. because the Talmud only spent their time focusing on things that were by this point practically applicable, which were not laws of things like animal sacrifice.
Right.
So
is that how we end up with, say, Ashkenaz and Sephardi? Because now we have people that are spreading out and applying those arguments to their particular situations and building types of practice depending on where they are. Is that sort of how that evolves?
Again, that's a great question. There are certain that certain parts of the Jewish world tend to follow the Chachmei Bavel, Chachmei, the rabbis of Babylon versus the rabbis of Israel, but it's not a black and white thing like that. It's much more nuanced than that. So all Jewish communities had access to the Yerushalmi and the Bavli. But when we see as that chain of transmission continues on, then you're going to see it gets more diversified with people following more specific individuals. The next group of rabbis, because now the center of the Jewish world moves to Babylon, we get to what's called the Gaonim. So we have a period of time, the Savaroyim, which is from the late 5th to the early 6th century, and they tweak the Talmud a little bit. But once you get to a period of time of the Gaonim in Babylon, which is the great yeshiva. It's basically the later 6th century until the mid 11th century, about a 500-year period where the center of the Jewish world is going to be centered on these big yeshivot in Sura and Pambadisia. And they will be further interpreting and continuing the transmission process and the interpretation and adaptation of Judaism, especially dealing with the circumstances of living in diaspora, the loss of certain basic fundamental features of Judaism, like animal sacrifice, priesthood, things like that. And then you enter, when you get to about 1,000 years ago, you enter a period of time called the Rishonim, the first ones. So you go from Tanayim to Amorayim. Tanayim are the Mishnah, Amorayim are the Talmud, Savarayim in the middle there, transitional, Gaonim, who are not writing any work of, they did write things, but there's no like one volume of work we attribute to them. But they're the halachic authorities, the leaders of the yeshivot in Babylon. And then you get to the Rishonim. And the Rishonim go pretty much to the expulsion of Jews from Spain into the 15th century. And these are people like the Rashi and the Rambam. And there's different generations of these people. There's generations of Tanayim, there's generations of Amorayim, there's generations of Rishonim. And the further away they're getting, they're great human beings, but the chain of transmission is getting, and they always have to. The difference is a Rishon doesn't have to go back to an earlier Rishon when he's trying to understand something halacha. He can go right back to the Talmud. Mm. And this brings us, by the way, to a really huge point, which is the big thing I learned when I was learning Hora'ah, which is how you come to a halachic position. And this is one of the things I always say, when it's worth memorizing. Halacha today, because there's Acharonim, there's later ones, and there's different scholars and books that came out in the Shulchan Aruch, and people attempting to codify and create works that everyone could focus on. By the way, the Shulchan Aruch, and it comes out right after the expulsion of Jews from Spain. It's like a later attempt of one rabbi with tremendous insight to come up with a unified code of law that the whole Jewish world can follow. And just like Yehuda Hanasi did many hundreds of years earlier, it becomes accepted as the standard code of practical application of Jewish law in the world then and until today. You have that same thing going on. How it works, halacha today, bottom line is, you can follow. And this is anyone who is independent in learning. Independent learning means you know how to read the sources yourself, and you don't have smicha to do this. By the way, there's people who the Chafetz Chaim never had rabbinic ordination. Rabbinic ordination today, again, is not like Rabbi Akiva putting his hands on my head. It's I did the learning, and then I could forget it all. I have to say, as someone who does not work in the rabbinic world, I don't get a lot involved in answering people's questions about kosher chickens. I'm a history guy. I got the qualification, so I can come to synagogues and be the rabbi for the weekend when I'm the scholar in residence, but it was not my job. There's people who specialize in being poskim and focusing on halacha application. But bottom line is, put it all together, halacha today is anyone who knows how to learn, and of course is objectively interested in truth, that's an important point, not looking for the answer you want to find, never chopping for psak, as they say, you can follow any Rishon's opinion on the Talmud is a valid halachic way to go, which means now that it's a little more nuanced than that, because generally whole communities tend to go a certain way. I have a son-in-law who's Yemenite, and he's a community of Yemenites who follow only it's called Baladi, and they only follow the Rambam, and that's exactly how it works. The Rambam is a Rishon. He was one of those rabbis who got to the period of time of expulsion of Spain. After that, just the authority of is considered to be weakened to the point where that's like sort of a line we cross where anything before has a different level of authority than anything after. So Rishonim are the last rabbis that can tell you the unbroken chain of transmission going back to Moses, and therefore their understanding of the Torah is sort of like the border, and everyone who comes later, they could be great Torah scholars, but the chain of transmission is weakened to the point where they're not on the same level of authority. Mm-hmm. So even though we generally live in communities where the community as a whole tends to follow, like Ashkenazim living in Toronto, who are from Northeast Europe and Poland and Lithuania, tend to follow certain opinions, and you're not supposed to break with your community, it is legitimate. And this separates that from everything else. I want to do what I want to do. I want to keep 15 minutes of keeping kosher, of milk to meat. You right. have to find a Rishon who's following an opinion of the Talmud. And that is considered legitimate within those red lines of halacha. And all Orthodox Jews will fall within those red lines. And everyone who falls outside that is no longer in that world. So that's, I know we're over time already. I know that was, and that was just skimming the surface, but that the really important thing to understand is the notion of the further back we go, the clearer the transmission is, and that there's an unbroken chain of transmission. There are rules of how one can apply things and draw things. And you have to know your limitations. You know, mm-hmm. I can't go and derive principles out of sentences in the Torah the way a rabbi 2,000 years ago could.
Right. And that we can't just sort of make legal loopholes unless we understand the depth and, like you said, the divinities and the details. Like, unless we really know all of the pieces, that's right. the only way that we can start to adjust or change or make it livable, for instance, right. with Prosbul or with Shemitah or with the Hetzer Mechira or things like that. So
exactly.
So
by the way, the rabbis also have authority to even, you know, suspend rabbinic law. They can't. We didn't even have the conversation. We probably should continue this conversation.
Yeah,
this
I feel like there's we should do
too much. We got to have another class of this because there's just too much to go in about rabbinic authority and right. what is considered, what is rabbinic authority and what is a minhag versus a custom. Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, he wrote a beautiful essay. He's such a great mind, the mm-hmm. Rav. And he talks about when going into a Gemara, learning a piece of Gemara, and he's suddenly entering a conversation with thousands of years of rabbis as if they're in the room with him. And the amazing thing is that we're part of an unending conversation that goes back to Moses at Mount Sinai, that while we have to show deference for those who know more than us and have a clearer chain of transmission, we can participate within that conversation and be part of the halachic process. It's not limited to just certain unique people throughout history. We're all links in that incredible chain of transmission.
Beautiful. Amazing. Thank you so much, Rabbi Spiro. This was so helpful. I think you're right. We will do a part two. In the meantime, for anyone who's listening to the podcast, please like, subscribe, share, or go back and listen to previous episodes. Leave us a review. Let us know what you think.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.